The Babylon Podcast was our last best hope for B5 fans. A self-contained show, 1 hour long, located on an RSS feed. A place for interviews and episode discussions for a whole bunch of humans and aliens. A shining beacon in cyberspace, all alone on the web. It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, the year the Lost Tales came upon us all. This is the podcast about the story of the last of the Babylon stations. The year is 2007. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to the Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And I be Jeffrey Willis. And guess what, kids? I am calling you this week from Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Some of those yellow bricks there, why don't you just put a couple in your pocket before you leave? They won't mind too much. They're souvenirs.
Well, here's a news flash for you, Tim. It's not quite like the James Bond movie, okay?
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, yeah. It's a little different than that, but I'm working on a project, a top secret project I really can't talk about, but it does involve our fighting men in the U.S. Navy SEALs, and it's pretty effing cool. So, yeah, I can tell you that tomorrow morning I have to wake up at O Dark 30 and put on my body armor. So I'm wearing body armor for a reason tomorrow, and in a subsequent episode. Exactly. So assuming I survive tomorrow, in a future episode, we'll be talking about this someday, but yeah.
So how does that quote go? It's 0630. What's the O stand for? Oh, my God, it's early.
That's pretty much what I'm thinking. Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right.
So we are continuing our Lost Tales extravaganza month.
Yes.
And I believe we have two chats today with people who were integrally involved with Babylon 5 at some point in time and who are still fans of the show that they worked on.
Yep. And they are also hardcore fans of B5 with valid opinions, if you will, about the Lost Tales. So we're going to touch base with Adam Francis, who was actually a PA on Babylon 5 during the second season, and our recurring guest, Tim Earls, our conceptual designer and artist extraordinaire, who will come and join us tonight.
And I believe he also worked on Lost Tales as well as the original B5 series.
Tim worked on Lost Tales?
I think so, yeah.
Well, we'll just have to clarify that. Well, that'll be cool.
We can ask him when we talk to him.
Exactly.
Excellent. I'm sorry that I can't make it for the whole show because I'm literally in a military debriefing, but I took a few moments to call you guys to be a part of the show tonight.
Well, whatever it is, you can declassify that show you're working on, and of course everyone will be happy to hear about it.
Well, I'm happy to just spill my guts, but I'd have to kill every one of you in the process, so.
Promises.
Hey, Tim, also, you should know that, I guess by the time this airs, but the first in a series of videos from the Lost Tales signing and release extravaganza that Warner Brothers put on is available online. So
we're
going to keep that going for a few more weeks and milk this for everything we can milk it for.
I don't think it's milking. I think we are...
Savoring.
It's our, savoring. Yeah, it's our Lost Tales of Palooza.
We are celebrating. We are celebrating having new Babylon 5 stories to talk about, welcoming new fans into the fold. Because as we heard last week, Brad, brought in somebody new just on Lost Tales. You got to love that.
Absolutely.
There you go.
Yeah. So,
and I've only watched it 5 times, so I need more time to watch it again.
So we will take a quick break and come back with our double guest interviews right after this.
There's a new podcast called The Geologic Podcast, a balanced, calm, rational look at the world and all of the people in it.
Motherfucker! Four notes away!
Alright, here's the deal. There's this guy, his name is George Rudd, and he's got this Geologic Podcast. Believe me, the last thing you want to do is listen to this garbage. I mean, look at the kind of things he does. He's got this one bit, it's called Religious Moron of the Week.
Religious Moron of the Week.
Then he does this stupid bit where his grandmother talks about entertainment news.
It must be time for Grandma's Entertainment Report.
Plus, this George character's got some strange fascination with animals where he talks about them in a thing called Interesting Fauna.
Interesting Fauna.
I mean, it's all just so stupid. The last thing you want to do is go to www.geologicpodcast.com and listen to this garbage. Believe me, your time will be better spent making yourself a sandwich or something.
www.geologicpodcast.com.
And we are back with more Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And with us on the phone, we have Adam Francis, who was actually a PA production assistant on the series, so I'm like really jealous already. You were in line at the Best Buy event, were you not?
Yes, I was. So how did it feel to be one of the first people to go in and win a life-size Bruce Boxleitner, Tracy Scoggin, and Peter Woodward action figure?
Well, you know, it felt like winning the gold medal at the Olympics, I guess. No. It was great to see, you know, Bruce again after all those years. You know, I was a PA in the second season, so it had been a while, and I never got the chance to meet Tracy or Peter Woodward. But it was cool to see them, of course, you know, exciting with the new DVD coming out and everything.
Right. So for those who are not well-versed in what a PA does, why don't you give a quick nutshell of what your responsibilities were on Babylon 5?
Okay. Well, PA is it's not the most exciting job. In fact, it's probably the most boring of all the jobs. But on Babylon 5, it was still pretty cool. Basically, the PA does whatever anybody in the department needs or wants. So it might be anything from running out to get some piece of the camera equipment that they need. It might involve, you know, organizing some files. It might involve, you know, going to get something for the actors or telling the actors they're needed on set. Any number of different small tasks. On Babylon 5, because it was mostly shot on stages, it meant that you got to spend a lot of time on the stages doing various things. I often would, you know, help clean up the stages after they'd been shooting on them or, you know, any kind of those things. And also a lot of script copying and stuff like that. So I got to see the scripts, like, fresh out of Joe's clearance to make copies for the whole crew and everything. So
wow.
I got to be one of the first to see those. That was pretty cool. And of
course, did you stand there at the copier then and read the scripts while you were copying them before anybody else got to it?
Yeah, well, you did get to do a little of that because you had to make so many copies, and then you had to make sure that every script had a complete, you know, there wasn't a page missing or something. So you had to page through them all, and, you know, so while you're doing that, you tend to read, you know, while you're going through. And, yeah, so I got to see a lot of what was going to happen before a lot of other people did, so that was pretty cool.
Now, how long were you on, were you a PA for the show?
I was only a PA on the second half of the second season because I was actually out there for college program. I was going to college in New York, and I got sort of an internship / PA job with them that I sort of begged them to take me on. John Copeland, the producer, was I was talking to him via the internet. He was nice enough to let me come in for an interview, and you know, they hired me on. So I did that while I was in college, and it was pretty amazing.
So were you?
Now, were you a fan of the show before you got hired as a PA? Did you know what Babylon 5 was?
Oh, yeah. I was a big fan. That's why I wanted to get the job on the show. I had been studying film in college for a while, and I had started watching Babylon 5 while I was in college, and I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And then I went out to L.A., and I was like, man, I need to get a job somewhere to get some experience while I'm out there. And, you know, I thought, well, hey, isn't Babylon 5 shut out there? So, and it just turned out at the time that John Copeland was posting on the old AOL forums at the time. And I didn't even know he was a producer, and I just said, hey, you work on the show. Do you know any way I could get on there? And he was like, well, I'm a producer, so yeah, I do. And so it worked out great. He came in, you know, let me come in for an interview, and I was psyched because I was a huge fan of the show, and I wanted to learn about filmmaking, so it was a great experience for me.
What did you learn while you were there? What was the most, I guess, rewarding part of the experience?
There were a lot of things from working on that show that were great. I mean, I learned all kinds of different departments because everyone knew, you know, I was there to learn. So lots of people would stop and talk to me and tell me what they were doing, what they were working on. You know, that was how I met Jeffrey. He was a stand-in at the time for Bruce Boxleitner and doing, you know, Kosh also. And, you know, he saw me hanging around and introduced himself. He was really nice to me and, you know, told me what was going on, and I talked, you know, to the camera crew and ADs and all kinds of stuff. I mean, I even got to be an extra on a couple episodes because the ADs, you know, thought, hey, you want to try it out? So I did that a couple times, and, you know, I learned a lot about the production department and the writing process and almost everything, you know. And I also learned what a great bunch of people there were on that show. I mean, I've worked on a bunch of shows since, and everybody on that show was so much nicer than you see on a lot of shows, and everybody really got along great. It was a lot of fun working on that show.
So let's turn it on its head. What was the weirdest thing that you had to do as a PA on Babylon 5? The thing that when they told you to do it, you sat there and said, I never in a million years would imagine I'd be doing something like this.
Well, I don't know about the weirdest, but probably one of the more embarrassing moments slightly weirdest was when they were working out costume tests for the Out of Kosh character, you know, Out of the Kosh suit character at mm-hmm. the end of season 2 there, and you know, the head and arm and the human and all. They were trying out some different costumes, and I'm kind of a tall, skinny guy. At least I used to be more skinny than I am now, and they said they wanted me at one point to try on that sort of leotard costume thing that the human Kosh was wearing when he comes out. Of course, the other crew members I knew thought that was kind of funny because they were like, "Ha, you're gonna be there in those tights in front of everybody. That'll be pretty embarrassing." And I came very close to having to do that, but then when they came up, I think they were changing the costume and I couldn't do it. And then they ended up, you know, getting somebody else to do it. But I potentially, you know, would have had to go in front of everyone with, you know, tights on and everything, and that would have been a little bit embarrassing.
So how did you keep in touch with the people you had met over the years? Did you follow people's career, just keep in touch with them? Did you get to work with anybody later?
Well, I have run into several people on various projects in the past, and I ran into some of the ADs and other people that I used to work with when I was working on other projects. And I kept in touch with them for a while. I know I went back in the later seasons. Well, I think they were shooting the TNT movies at the time. I came back to L.A. after graduating college, and, you know, I met up with some of the people on the crew, and they even got me another extra slot on one of the TV movies, I think. And, you know, I hung out with some of them back then. And but, you know, as time went by and you work on so many different shows, you tend to sort of lose track, so I haven't talked to a lot of them over the years. But which is why it was kind of a huge shock when I ran into Jeffrey at the Babylon 5 signing, and he recognized me, and I hadn't seen him in, like, I don't know, like 8 years or something, and he was like, hey, I know you. And I was like, you do? I wouldn't know me. So
yeah, but he's the Vorlon, so he knows all that stuff.
I guess, yeah. He can remember all the pebbles that have become an avalanche or whatever, I guess.
As your career has gone forward, Adam, did you ever interview for a job and when they look at Babylon 5 on your resume, go, oh, wow, you worked on that? I mean, did you ever get any, you know, I guess, for lack of a better term, geeky responses from having that on your resume?
Not too often, just because Hollywood is so jaded about everything. But I do remember at least one interview where somebody else was a fan and was like, hey, no way, Babylon Fire, that's cool. I knew somebody who worked on that or something. That's usually what you get is people are afraid to admit that they're a fan of something sometimes in Hollywood, but they'll often like say they worked with somebody who worked on the same thing or something like that. But you know, even now I have, you know, so much stuff on my resume from the various films and TV shows I worked on over the years that I had to drop a lot of stuff off of my resume, you know, just to save space that wasn't, you know, so important. But I leave Babylon 5 on there because I think that's one of the cooler things I've worked on. And, you know, I think at least some people it catches their attention. So,
how was it for you when you saw that more Babylon 5 was coming along? Did you feel just excited?
Oh, yeah. I've been one of those people who was kind of like hoping for something for years. You know, I was pissed about Crusades, you know, Untimely Fate, and, you know, had hoped that maybe Legend of Rangers might play out or something and all that. So when all that kind of didn't work out, I was kind of bummed, and I was pretty psyched when I heard that the new DVD was going to be coming along. And, you know, of course, I'm hoping it sells well, so there'll be more in the future.
So what was your general opinion of Lost Tales?
Well, as a story, I thought it was pretty good. You know, it wasn't a big, huge tale, but I think that's not what Joe wanted to do. It was entertaining. It definitely had this sort of Babylon 5 feel to it, and I thought the effects looked really great. I love what they did with, like, the jump gate and the station and stuff. I think that you could, you know, I know a lot of people have supposedly been talking about how it looks kind of sparse and all of that, and I agree a little bit. It did feel like the station was a bit empty at times, and I guess it sort of missed the days where there were, like, you know, 80 extras cramming into one little room, making it look like a huge crowded place. But, you know, I realized this was kind of a first attempt for Warner Brothers, and they're not going to go all out right now. So I think for what they did, I think it came out pretty well. What did you guys think?
I loved it. It took me a while to warm up to the first story, but I loved the second story from the get-go.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I also was very thrilled with it, and one of the things that I'm pleased with it most is that they, recognizing as the budget limitations or whatever, that they didn't go all out for some sprawling epic, you know, that these are small, intimate stories, and I think they succeed very well for that.
Yeah, I agree with the both of what you said. I thought the first story, it started a little bit slow for, like, the first Babylon 5 back after all these years. It was a bit quiet in the beginning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it sort of warmed up to me as I was watching it, and I thought, you know, in the end it had a pretty decent conclusion. And, of course, you know, the Sheridan story I thought was great. And, you know, I think it's good for what they were trying to do, these kind of small, not epic stories that are sort of part of, you know, more anthology-like part of the universe sort of thing.
Now, if we get our wish and we do get more stories, would that be something you'd want to work on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if there was any, I mean, that was one thing I kind of regretted. I remember when I was a PA on the show, I used to talk to people on the crew during lunch, and I'd be like, man, I should just quit college and stay here with you guys and just work, you know, on this show. It's so awesome. I love this job. And they were like, no, stay in college. You don't want to go to work. You know, that's no fun. I realized after I graduated that they were kind of right that, you know, college is more fun than working, but Babylon 5 was a rare case where that wasn't really true. Even though I was basically one of the lowest people on the crew, I loved every day on that show. It was just everyone was so great to work with, and it was a whole lot of fun, and I loved the show. And, you know, I was kind of bummed, but by the time I graduated, they were basically, you know, finishing up the television movies. And, you know, they tried out Crusade, but I couldn't really get on to that, you know, so I didn't really get a chance to do that again. But, yeah, if I could go back and work on anything Babylon 5, I'd do it in a second.
Adam, having worked behind the scenes on a production like Babylon 5, how often or do you ever find yourself watching something from the PA's point of view and going, oh, my God, I can't believe they did that?
I don't really watch much from the PA's point of view because I've long since moved past being a PA, basically. But I have, you know, from a production point of view, I can watch something and be sort of like, what were they doing there? Or I can't believe they tried to do that edit, or what are they thinking when they set up this shot or something like that. But Yeah, and I have to admit I was analyzing the Babylon 5 DVD a little bit, trying to, you know, think about how it was on set while I was watching it, you know, what the sets looked like and, you know, how much crew was there and what they were up to and stuff like that.
So what are you working on now, and what are you doing?
Well, my life has taken a few weird twists and turns, and I actually just very recently came back from 3 years of living in Japan. I had sort of gotten tired of the industry, actually, because there's so many, you know, people who just don't have a good attitude about what they're doing. And I'd always wanted to go to Japan, so I sort of left the industry behind and went to Japan for 3 years to teach English, just to, you know, do something new and different. And just recently come back from that, so I'm doing some freelance, you know, editing work and stuff right now, and just sort of doing what I feel like until I want to jump into something bigger. Cool.
Well, so. that is great to hear, and I'm really glad that you came out to the big event and was recognized by people you used to work with. And
yeah, it was pretty amazing to be recognized by somebody, because again, one thing I have to say is when you're the low end of the totem pole on most film and TV shows, that nobody knows who you are except for the other bottom end people, like producers and stuff like that. They don't remember anybody. And you know, I know Jeffrey was, you know, he did pretty well on that show, and for him to remember me after all these years, it kind of felt good that, you know, even though I was so low, that somebody remembered me at the time. So that was nice.
I think that's really a testament to just the attitude everybody had about the project they were working on, because everybody knew it was special. And I think maybe people just remembered who was around because it was such a special event, a special show.
Yeah, I've never seen a show like that where, I mean, like, the entire crew cared what the next story was going to be. I mean, I've worked on so many shows where everyone went, man, this script is crap, this show is terrible, I'm just getting money. This was one show where, like, everybody was like, oh, did you see the new script? Oh, can you believe they did that to Garibaldi? Or, you know, whatever. And it was like, it was amazing, you know. So it was a good time. And, yeah, I think anybody who was a part of that would say that they remember those years fondly.
Yeah, we've interviewed Bruce Boxleitner twice, and in the first one he recounted that he, you know, having already worked on series television, you know, informed the rest of the cast and crew to enjoy this experience because Babylon 5 was unlike any show that he had ever worked on, and knew it was going to be unlike any show anybody had ever worked on in terms of the camaraderie and everything else, so.
Yeah, I was totally spoiled because, like I said, that was my first sort of real job, you know, when I was learning in the film industry, and I thought, wow, this is what film's like, man, this is an awesome job, and unfortunately, I got a little fooled because most jobs are not that great. So.
Well, here's hoping that all of the lowly crew members who worked on Babylon 5 can inspire others to create their own shows with such a great atmosphere. So I'd like to thank you for your time tonight, Adam.
No problem.
It's been really, really great. I can't get enough of talking to people who actually worked on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to talk about it some more.
Great. Well, thanks again, Adam. We really appreciate your insights.
This is Captain Yarstow, EAS Netherlands.
Area playing him, command post, reporting.
This is NBS-1, squad leader Tijan.
We are not hostile. I repeat, we are not hostile.
The Corps is mother, the Corps is father.
I will need to protect the interests of our people.
Battles we fought here at Orion 7 in the name of freedom.
Three-Edged Sword. Episode 10. The Storm.
Captain's log, EAS Netherlands, 74 days after secession. I'm about to leave my quarters and head to the bridge. The enemy Starfuries are suddenly closing fast, and our own Starfury complement has just launched. We've still got quite a while before the distance drops down to combat range, but we've already flipped over the Netherlands to drift backwards towards the Orion 7 jump gate, with our main armament pointed towards the enemy. Although this is going to make it a bit harder for navigation, I've ordered no acceleration to meet the enemy. We will still meet short of Orion 7, but I want to postpone that meeting as long as possible. I've attached the initial after-launch assessment Lieutenant Commander Jacobs sent in to this log.
One attachment found.
Tactical assessment log. Lieutenant Commander Jacobs reporting. Our squadrons were holding position more or less. All wings are currently trying to close the gap between us and the enemy Furies, albeit slowly. The Narn continue to resist assuming our attack vectors. Even they must see the need to accelerate to attack speeds as the enemy arrives. Slow-moving fighters will just be too vulnerable to the enemy's targeting systems. Jacobs out.
This is NBS-1 to Beta Squadron. Maintain defensive position. Bogies on approach vector 135/040. ETA, 30 minutes on my mark. Mark, remember our orders. We are to hold at this forward position long enough for the Netherlands to get a firing solution on the Psi-Corps capital ship. Their Star Furies will be looking to punch a hole to clear the way. Keep the fires hot here, we force them to adjust. We can let hyperspace in the Netherlands do the rest. NBS-1 out. Squad leader to NBS-2. Confirm target assignments. NBS-5 is still showing red on the port blister. Adjust accordingly. We'll only have the element of surprise once, so timing is critical. We wait until we're out of range of the Netherlands' defenses. I'll give the order to engage the Psi-Corps Star Furies. When Beta Squadron pulls out to engage, we target and fire. Confirm that our weapons are set to the correct specifications. No mistakes. Timing is critical if our plan is to succeed.
Mission update. Operation Dutch Courage, Sirius Planum Command Post. After receiving intel on the Netherlands' comm problems, the command staff has ordered the attack to begin immediately. This is the first deployment of the Central Command and Control attack protocol enabled by the linked array. All command operations will be directed from Sirius Planum, with orders and deployments routed through this comm station. Open attack log. Epsilon and Zeta squads maintain escort formation. All attack fighters prepare for full acceleration. Vector attack run to sectors 26/7/12 and 26/8/13. Black Omega's point, Alpha Squad flank 270, Beta Squad flank 90. Make sure the Star Furies are between you and the Narn. Gamma and Delta squads, target the Narn and fly the horns at flank 0 and 180. The Netherlands must see us targeting all fighters. Accelerate on my mark. Mark. Do not attack until the Star Furies clear the inner firing radius. The Narn will lag behind them. Gamma and Delta squads hold fire until the Narn engage. Once they commit, assist or take them out. Alpha, Beta, deflect flank 3 degrees. Maintain current course and speed. Linked array is detecting an unusual disturbance. Focusing in on the area now.
Three-Edged Sword is brought to you by Voices of Babylon.
And we're back with more Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm still Tim Callender.
And we have with us today our a Babylon 5 favorite conceptual artist, Tim Earls. Welcome, Tim.
Hi.
Glad to have you
here again.
Back on the show. And now you worked on The Lost Tales, right?
I did.
Okay, now you really have to dish everything.
Okay.
So what actual parts did you work on for the movie?
I mainly just did storyboarding. I storyboarded all the scenes and visual effects.
Oh.
And that's pretty much it.
But that sounds like a lot.
It was a lot because I had to break down the script into, you know, packets of scenes and try to, you know, set up all the shot angles and things like that, and Joe pretty much let me run with it.
How much lead time did you have before shooting?
I think I only had maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And then they definitely need the storyboards by the end of that week. I actually went did two. Let's see what happened. It was, originally there were three scripts, and one of the scripts was very CG intensive, so they decided to cut that one back, eliminate that one, and put the rest of the efforts in the other two. So I actually storyboarded three, but ended up having to refine one of them.
Can you give us some insight about what that third script was going to be?
I can't remember the exact words, but it had something to do with Garibaldi on Mars. Hence, it was very CG intensive. Not that the other two aren't going to be CG intensive. That one was particularly intensive.
Were there any like special instructions or anything that Joe had for you, or did he, like, from knowing your work from before, just say, "Here, go with it"?
He pretty much said, "Go with it." I'm sure anything you come up with would be good, so I did. And there were no complaints, so I guess I did okay.
Did Joe come to you on any particular point and say, "Here's what I'm looking for," to give you guidance then at any point?
Actually, no. He just sent me the scripts, and I just went through, and as I said, I ran with it. I when I read a scene, read the dialogue, and all that, I formed a picture in my head, gathering from experience from storyboards that I did for some of the B5 directors. I was able to, you know, come up with a whole line of shots for Joe, and he actually didn't have me change anything. So
really,
I'm very keen to see what the final result is and how much they deviated from the storyboards.
Oh, so you have not yet seen the finished product?
I've only seen one scene, actually one image. Well, I take that back. I've actually seen a preview of some of the CG. And I've seen a CGnetwork.com has an article, which I did an interview for, that has some screen grabs from the two episodes.
Oh, well, Tim, now I'm not quite sure what to say to you because, well, you've seen the scripts, so that you know how the stories work out.
Yes.
So in that sense, it's not a surprise to you.
Right.
Well,
but the final product is still going to be a surprise because I want to see what these guys have done with the story.
Now, were you involved with any of the CG designs?
That's funny you say that because I was thinking that I may be doing some conceptual designs on, you know, some of the ships, and it's very funny because there are a couple of scenes with the Minbari transport, and it had to be a new thing. And while I'm doing the storyboards, of course, the storyboard's not that detailed. They pretty much, you know, show general shapes and action and points of view. But when I saw the previews, I saw this Minbari cruiser, and it looked almost exactly like the little cruiser that I sketched in the storyboards. So I guess I did have some impact on that. That was a nice surprise.
So, did you do any storyboarding on the sock puppet segment?
The sock puppet? Which one's this?
Apparently you didn't.
You're pulling my leg, right?
No, there was
actually.
There was a big presentation at Comic-Con that involved reenacting scenes with sock puppets, I believe.
and there's also a couple extras on the DVD,
yes,
where JMS pitches the sock puppet concept to an exec from Warner Brothers, and then actually they show the sort of the behind the scenes as they film the sock puppet scene.
Oh, nice! I had no
very
idea.
Dramatic.
I was like, if you had worked on that, I would have to. It's like, how do you storyboard a sock puppet?
Right.
So, how would you approach a sock puppet storyboard?
Well, it's all POV, point of view. That'd be interesting to direct, I think.
Well, Joe seemed pretty pleased with the
results.
I can visualize that now.
I can visualize almost anything you could describe.
So, going forward with Lost Tales, would you want to continue to be involved with that project?
I would love to be even more involved than I had been when I got the call, I was putting too much into it, but I was assuming that I'd do more than just storyboards. So if the opportunity does arise, I would absolutely jump at it.
Really. Now, we've asked this question of other people who've been expecting the Lost Tales, but as a fan of the series, what stories would you want to actually see and work on?
I'd like to see what happened to, was it Jakar that took off?
Mm-hmm.
I would like to find out what happened to him and what he did. And Lita went with him, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd definitely like to find out what they did.
I think the story I would most like to see would be what happened to Lita and Lanier during the Telepath War.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that seems to be high on most people's list. I read that a lot with the emails.
I said anything with Lita involved?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It seems to be a fan favorite.
Right. So, Tim, what have you got next on your slate for projects?
Well, you know, I've been trying to get on the new Star Trek feature. And I kind of lobbied with the production designer early on a few months ago, and then with the art director. But unfortunately, the art department there went digital. And so they don't have any hand-drawing set designers or illustrators. Actually, they have John Eves. I think he's probably the only one illustrating with markers. Everybody else has gone digital. So that kind of left me on the cold because I didn't have the software to do what they need to do. But they're keeping my name on the back burner just in case they need extra work. But at the moment, I'm working on a new sitcom called Pushing Daisies. I don't know if you've seen the pilot.
Oh, yeah.
We've heard about that one, yeah.
Is that the one with Kristen Chenoweth?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hilarious. I have to tell you, I've only been there 4 days, and you know, I read the script for this next episode, and I just cracked up. And it has to be funny if I actually crack up and somebody else is in the room.
Yeah, that's we had done a story about that on Slice of Sci-Fi. It's when this guy talks to the dead. He can bring them back to life for a couple of minutes and talk to them.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people are waiting for that one to see if it's going to be as funny as it's touted to be, and if you're cracking up, I'm guessing that's a good sign.
It's a riot. It's an absolute riot. I think it's going to be great. And it's so off the wall. Do you know how, you ever watch Scrubs?
Not in a while, but yeah.
But you know, you kind of know they're kind of comedy.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Sometimes they have
nice.
Weird things happening that completely non sequitur. Well, that's what happens in this series. It's just, things just come out of nowhere. Well, what's that about?
So what is your role for that show? Is it production designer or
conceptual artist? I'm set designing on this one.
Ooh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just I did a windmill today.
Any Minbari influence on that windmill?
Sadly, no. I don't think they always got it.
So does Pushing Daisies have you busy enough that that's your only project right now?
Pretty much, but I'm also still working on a little project for quantum mechanics regarding Serenity.
Yeah, they just sent us some new information. They had just came out with the Serenity papers. They're coming out with a new Galactica limited edition. So you've got something even newer Serenity related for them?
Yes.
Oh, I'm so jealous.
So yeah,
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I think it's going to be kind of cool. It kind of plays off some of the artwork that I did for the original series. So you'll get a little idea of what the other versions of Serenity were.
Oh, nice. Oh, I'm so jealous. I'm so jealous. But I would love to have you back on again to talk about more Lost Tales. Hopefully they'll bring you on when they do have more, and I'm saying when because I'm really thinking positively on this, but I'd like to thank you for your time this evening.
Sure.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Tim.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I mean that. It's not being
serious. Yeah, we appreciate that.
We do.
Very much.
And we will be back with more Babylon Podcast right after this.
This is Tabitha Smith, and I am currently stalking the Pod Culture crew. Glenn, Brad, Christina, they're all over there. We have to be really, really quiet, though, so they don't know we're stalking them. I am doing the whole in-the-bushes thing, which is kind of creepy and weird, but once you listen to the episodes, you'll understand why I'm doing it. So, yeah, join with me in listening to Pod Culture, and you can check them out at podculture.net. Join the stalking revolution.
Digging down to the obscurest facts in fandom. This is Deep Geeking.
And we are back with more Deep Geeking on a continuation of talking about Over Here, the first story on the Lost Tales DVD. And in case you weren't aware, oh yeah, we got spoilers coming.
You think?
Yeah, I
think. Come on, people. You've had a chance to watch this four or five times by now.
At least. Yes. So, yes, we're going to pick back up where we left off with Lockley and Cassidy saying, there's a piece missing from this story. What is it we are missing?
And one of the things that I really liked, I liked the shot. It's got the nice, tinkly, introspective music as we come in on the sleeping Lockley. And as soon as she opens her eyes, the music just stops abruptly. Ah, screw it, she says. And she starts thinking about it. She starts, you know, Burke, you poor bastard. You didn't deserve this. You know, you just never, you know, you minded your own business. And then she's like, wait a minute. And then starts realizing that he wasn't on the station the whole time. He went to Earth. And sure enough, when checking the ship's logs for the Starliner that brought him back from Babylon 5, the captain noted the same low temperature and the same horrible smell. She goes, aha, that's it, and puts the pieces together. Mm-hmm. And I liked, again, going back to the original series history, Babylon 5, when they're walking down the corridor, here she is striding resolutely forward, and Cassidy says, you sure you know what you're doing? And she goes, no, but that's never stopped me before. You know, and you think back of dealing with telepaths and everything else. So, and she goes in and basically confronts the thing inside Burke and says, you know what? You did a good job. You almost had us thinking we had only two choices. Exercise you here quietly and, you know, defeat God's purpose, or wait until we can bring priests out and make a big deal and exorcise you out here. But there's a third choice, and that's to send you back to Earth where you came from, where your prison is, when you were cast down and imprisoned on Earth. I liked her phrase, this isn't a revelation, it's an ecclesiastical jailbreak.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, Burke has been, you know, heavily sedated, and he's kind of going under as Lockley starts railing at him. Maybe it's not quite the right word, but just basically, you know, hounding him. And says, you know what, you know, you did a good job trying to fool us, but you can't fool us. And we know in the future we're going to leave Earth because the sun's going to go out, and we're going to survive. But there's no place for the likes of you. And with that, Burke sort of passes out.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. It's like you were cast down, so Earth is your prison, but without humans on Earth, what do you have to do? What do you have to look forward to? What happens when we're gone and you're there by yourselves? And calling it an ecclesiastical jailbreak was kind of cool because,
yeah,
you know, what if once he's exercised, he's in space. He's out. He's free from the bonds of Earth. If her theory is correct, he has made his escape and is free to wreak havoc among the stars, among other races.
Right. Yes.
Now, I think Father Cassidy first looked surprised by that assessment, that theory of hers. And I wonder if he actually will keep that in mind for the future. Not just for keeping an eye out for this kind of behavior for other potential jailbreakers, like he said, but... Right. Something to I guess, help revive the faith back home. It's like we aren't losing faith because we're going into the stars. We've evolved. We've become enlightened. We can leave behind our fears and our jailers.
Good point. But also with that, you know, we have to maintain a certain amount of vigilance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because the thing, you know, made it very clear that it is all about wreaking havoc and causing great distress. You know, earlier when it's saying, you know, here's, you know, we were, so, you know, giving the story, we were salted out here by God, and, you know, your soul's in danger, Father, because, you know, here's your choice. You can either leave us in here and damn this poor innocent man, but keep it all quiet. Or you can, you know, exercise us, but then, you know, you've got this huge stink going on, and, you know, is that really what you want? And, you know, Cassidy says, why are you telling me this? And he says, because it gives us pleasure to do these things, but, you know, to torment you. So, of course, you know, in the end, you know, Lockley figures it out. Burke's going to be sent back to Earth, and I like that little exchange. I've got some friends, Lockley says, back home that I can trust that will be able to keep an eye out for these kinds of things. They'll call me, and I'll call you.
Right.
Which, I'm not quite sure what to make of that.
He either has low friends in high places or high friends in low places.
But why would you even need... I mean, I guess maybe, you know, somebody you can trust in so far as...
Somebody who can who you can trust who wouldn't hear your story and think you're crazy.
Right, there you go. That was what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing is once she would need to coordinate with someone, I guess, more aware of the comings and goings of space transit. Because you can't station a priest at every spaceport.
No, you can't.
And if you have people in the military, in the transit, the shipping companies, who can spot something like this and make a call to Colonel Lockley and say,
sure.
Remember that thing you told me to keep an eye out for? There's someone like that on, you know, Starliner Aurora heading for Io or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Somebody just double-checking the databases.
Yeah.
Oh, we got a report of, 20-degree drop in internal temperature despite the environmental units being okay. Ah, all right, thank you. So, and then, of course, at that point, at the end of the little episode, Lockley has to leave to go get things ready for President Sheridan's impending arrival for the big celebration,
mm-hmm.
and closes her personal log by saying that... the reason that she doesn't take a cushy desk job at this point in her career is that Babylon 5 is her home. And she knows that when the darkness comes, she's in the one place where the lights are always on.
Yep.
Which I liked. So that's it in a nutshell over a week and a half. So, Summer, what was your – let's get to the taken apart. What was your reaction to this story?
At first, I didn't know where it was going. I honestly couldn't see – where the story was going, what the point of this story as it relates to the themes of Babylon 5 was going to be. And then that little twist came in when Lockley figured it out, and she's explaining it to the possessed Burke as he's literally falling under the influence of the, you know, quintuple dose of whatever it was they gave him.
Yeah, right.
And that was a rather insightful deduction.
Uh-huh.
Not just of where he became possessed, but why he was so insistent on being exercised out in space.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I was like, whoa, I didn't see that coming. Never heard that theory before, but damn, that's cool.
Right.
Once I sat back and thought about the episode, one thing came to mind that could have been done two different ways. Is it protocol to have someone who is possibly suffering from some sort of mental instability, is it protocol to have them peek that by a telepath? And would a telepath have been able to determine that there was another personality inhabiting that body?
On theoretical grounds, my guess would be a telepath would be able to determine that. I think the issue becomes we are now in a period of Babylon 5 universe history where the Psi-Corps no longer exists.
Psi-Corps doesn't exist, but telepaths are still there. There are telepaths in Earth Force. There are telepaths still doing commercial work. It's not like they've been eradicated. They're still there.
No, that's true, but the question becomes, well, you know what? I think the whole issue really sidesteps this and gets to a more interesting question. Let's assume that there would be some sort of a telepath available to make the scan. And Lockley sidesteps it. Why? Because as she obviously indicates in this episode, she has a traditional religious upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And by traditional, I mean that, you know, certainly Judeo-Christian, arguably Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes right to the heart of the matter. She doesn't need a telepath to tell her that this guy is possessed by the devil or something.
Mm-hmm.
She knows it. Temperature's dropped. You know, he's covered in blood, but there's no DNA. He's holding himself up in a chapel.
Cassidy
might have 8 signs that he needs to have fulfilled,
right,
to indicate demonic possession, but Lockley doesn't.
But I still think somewhere along the line, because she said they had them examined by doctors. Wouldn't a doctor have requested that a telepath scan him? Why didn't Father Cassidy say, well, you know, maybe a telepath can tell us for sure?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, are there no telepaths that have taken the cloth ever? After Psi-Corps was dissolved, probably yes. Before, no. You're right.
Right.
Another thing that was brought up by the fans, and this was a twist on it that I didn't think of, all of the tricks that Simon Burke did could have been done by a very strong telepath.
Oh, I'm convinced that that it was some sort of a telepathic thing, that it wasn't necessarily, except for the blood, can't quite explain that one away. But yes, otherwise, everything else is definitely the hallmarks of telepathy. And one of the things that I like to borrow from Galen in Over There, we are surrounded by mysteries on all sides.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind that it's not necessarily pinned down exactly the nature of this entity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that one of the beauties of it is that JMS has given it enough of a science fictional twist to explain possession in terms of, you know, some sort of an alien entity. And so, yes, I think a lot of it was, you know, telepathic. I think a lot of it was, you know, those kinds of impressions,
mm-hmm.
you know, not necessarily physical manifestations, but it's just as effective now, isn't it?
It is. But I was thinking more of this was a telepath who'd had a psychotic break and was having delusions of grandeur to get attention. You know, this person, Simon Burke, is a telepath, or he has a split personality that's a stronger telepath. We saw that happen where somebody
or maybe
with
he's a Psi-Corps experiment that was just kind of forgotten.
Gone bad. Yeah, a Psi-Corps experiment gone way, way bad, and he just kind of got forgotten in the war. No problem.
Right, right.
So, yeah, that's a possibility. But I like the angle that was taken. It's like, we're not going to exercise you out here and free you from your cage. We're sending you back where you're still bound to Earth. So, tough noogies.
Yeah, and it also, you know, in terms of the mythology of Babylon 5, cast it in this light. There was a war of first ones, and these guys were the losers and bound to this third rock from the sun someplace in some obscure solar system, you know. And for the locals, the native population, you could translate that as a war of the God and the angels, and, you know, okay, we'll call him Lucifer, and he gets cast down. See, I like that. And you know, one of the things, in a bigger sense, one of the things I really liked about the story is it is so different a Babylon 5 story, and yet still remains a Babylon 5 story, that whatever preconceptions you have about what the Lost Tales might have been, because let's face it, we have been anticipating this for years,
mm-hmm.
all right?
it completely sidesteps any of those. There's no spaceships, no aliens, really. I mean, you know, we just argued the nature of this entity, but that's irrelevant, ultimately. But it does get down to personal choices and beliefs. And, you know, I mean, it becomes about the characters, which is what we've all responded to as fans to Babylon 5 in the first place. And I think that Straczynski did a great job of rolling that out as one of the first lost tales, because it's just like, you know, your reaction to it, I think, is a fine indication. It's like, where is he going with this? So, you know, you completely forget about anything else. You're just you're caught up in the story. And I love the camera work in it. The camera work in that is really fantastic. You know, when they're interviewing Burke, there's this sort of disorientated sway as he, you know, pans across the faces. I don't know if you notice on a couple occasions when Burke would deliver some particular portentous line, all of a sudden the wall behind him would kind of light up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just little things like that. You know, the little voices at the end where Lockley is talking to him.
Right.
You know, just really, really neat little things like that.
It's the little
so, very
things.
Enjoyable. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And, you know, so if there's any quibble, I think Lockley's soliloquy at the end gets a little long, maybe. But you know what? You know, not so bad in the end. And I think as we've commented in previous shows, you know, we're basically stuck in a hallway. And I think, you know, that I think if there's one real quibble is Lockley's quarters don't look like quarters that a commander of a space station has been living in for 9 years.
Ooh. Maybe they had to do some remodeling.
Yeah, and she's in a temporary. I mean, her bedroom looked an awful lot like Burke's cell, except that she had a window. You know, I mean, there's nothing on the walls. There really wasn't any furniture in there. I'll give you the Marvel No Prize that they moved her into temporary quarters because they were renovating her office space or whatever. Sure.
There you go.
But again, you know, I mean, that only again, as I said prior, that just more speaks to the fact that the crew was given a limited budget to do this thing on.
Right.
Otherwise, it was effective. So.
Yeah. So I think. Have we covered everything? I think
we have.
All the major points.
I'm sure our listeners will be sending in volume
many,
and
many comments.
Voicemails about it, but that's fine too. That's why we do that.
And that will do it for this episode of the Babylon Podcast. If you'd like to submit a comment, you can send an email to babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Or give us a call and leave a voicemail message at 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Dear Asmodeus, try to make a break for it.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.